next speaker has probably a little more stronger views on some of these issues. And it's Professor Robert Paulberg, and he's the B.F. Johnson Professor of Political Science at Wellesley College, an adjunct professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School, and an associate at Harvard's Weatherhead Center for International Affairs. His principal research interests are international food and ag policy. He has been a member of Board of Agriculture and Natural Resources at the National Research Council of the National Academies in the U.S., and a recent consultant to IFPRI, USAID, the World Bank, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He is the author of books from Cornell University Press, Johns Hopkins University Press, and Chicago University Press. One of his most recent books is titled Food Politics. If people haven't gotten their hands on that, it's a really interesting read. He received his BA from Carleton College and his PhD in government from Harvard University. And he'll be talking about food prices, hunger riots, land grabs, and food wars. So a lot of these issues that have come up in previous talk and some of the questions will hopefully be explored in this discussion. Robert Paulberg, thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Anwar. You mentioned that I got my undergraduate degree at Carleton College. I tell my friends when they ask me where I went to school, I say Carleton. They said, oh, you went to school in Canada. And, I should have been so lucky. This is my first visit to McGill. It's a pleasure to be here. And as Anwar mentioned, my talk is going to anticipate some of the concerns in upcoming sessions about managing food price volatility and also the political consequences of food price volatility. I'm going to be addressing the socio-political dimension of global food security, which came back into prominence following the food price spike of 2007-2008, which coincided with the spike in food price riots, so-called food price riots, in a number of countries around the world. The impression emerged from these events that food price spikes were causing social and political unrest and even violent conflict. And now we constantly hear predictions that if high prices continue, food riots will continue, social unrest will continue. This is generating predictions from an organization in my hometown, Cambridge, Massachusetts, the New England Complex Systems Research Institute, which has predicted that if the high prices we've seen in 2012 persist into 2013, the world will become a tinderbox, and we will have more unrest and more political change than, well, maybe even than we had in the Arab Spring when high prices prevailed in 2011. The reason this is an alarming forecast is that the new trend toward higher international food prices has been underway for a decade now, and with the drought in the United States in summer 2012, it looks unlikely to stop anytime soon. This FAO food index of international commodity prices, food commodity prices, you can see that for the last 10 years it's been a reversal of the downtrend. It's been an uptrend. You see two price spikes here in 2007, 2008, and again in 2010, 2011. This doesn't show the 2012 spike, which so far is not as steep as the 2011 spike. We're still 9% below the all-time peak of February 2011, but we don't know where things are going in the future. And we know that in the past, spikes in international prices have coincided with social unrest. The top line in this chart is the FAO food price index, and the center line is a count of news stories about social unrest, and you can see the corresponding spikes in food prices and news stories about social unrest in 2008 and then again in 2011. But before buying into this alarmist narrative about the connection between international food prices and social or political unrest, I'd like to suggest we examine some important distinctions. And let me run through these one at a time. The first is a distinction between international food prices and food shortages. We instinctively assume that if food prices go up, well, food supplies must have gone down. But it isn't that simple. In 2008, the international price of rice tripled at a time when rice production was increasing more rapidly than rice consumption around the world, and rice stocks were growing. Globally, there was no shortage of rice. The international price spike resulted from a sudden shortage of rice available for export caused by trade policy changes in a number of countries, including India, China, Indonesia, Cambodia, Vietnam, and Egypt. These countries either banned exports of rice all at the same time, or they placed restrictions on exports of rice. That caused a temporary shortage of rice available for export in the world market, and that spiked the international price of rice, but only, as I think Prabhu Bengali pointed out, only about 6% of rice consumption around the world is satisfied through the international market. So most rice consumers around the world weren't seeing anything close to a tripling of rice prices. This leads to a second important distinction between international food prices and domestic food prices. The food price data I've put up so far, the FAO Food Price Index, these are measures of the price of food available for export. For rice, this is the price of rice available for export in Bangkok. It's not the price of rice on the streets in Mumbai or Montreal. The international price of wheat is the price of wheat available for export in New Orleans. It's not the price of wheat on the streets of Delhi. Domestic prices are different from international prices. The first thing I learned when I studied this was that if someone ever mentions the price of food, you should instantly ask that person where. The price of food isn't uniform around the world. It is location specific. Domestic prices differ from international prices in part because of weak transport infrastructure that separates domestic markets physically from international trade, but also because most national governments around the world don't trust international food markets. And over the years, they've used a number of policy instruments to insulate themselves from international price fluctuations, including the export bans that I mentioned a moment ago, plus domestic buffer stock management systems, plus state trading. Governments will procure food abroad through state purchases at a high price and then make it available on the domestic market at a much lower price to insulate their domestic consumers from international price fluctuations. Because national government policies such as these are operating all the time, prices on the domestic market tend to be less volatile than prices on the international market. For example, when the international wheat price spiked in the spring of 2011, the price of wheat on the streets in New Delhi was lower than it had been a year previously, and it was in a decline, not in an increase. One reason governments in developing countries can so easily isolate their domestic markets from world markets is their long history of not trusting world markets and restricting imports of foreign food staples under policies of national food self-sufficiency. In India, for decades now, it's been extremely difficult for exporters of wheat and rice to make sales inside the Indian market. The government of India doesn't want foreign food staples coming into their market in the name of international food national self-sufficiency. So in 2008 or 11, when the world price spikes, India is already pre-isolated from the consequences. Of course, being sealed off in the world market isn't a particularly safe posture to be in if you're a small country, a landlocked country, a poor country in Africa. If you don't have access to the world market, you are extremely vulnerable because a local drought is going to cause a food shortage inside your national food system and a huge price spike, even though prices on the world market may be low or falling. That's not going to help you at all. Another important distinction is between income deprivation and food deprivation. When food prices in domestic markets do rise for whatever reason, the result will be some reduction in food consumption, especially consumption of meat products or luxury foods. But the demand for staple foods tends to be highly inelastic, so people will mostly pay the higher price, consume nearly as much food as they were previously, and cut back on the consumption of non-food items like haircuts or new shoes or bus trips to visit their relatives. People will start living with less income for non-food consumption, and this will be painful and it will make them angry, but it is not the same thing as going hungry. And this leads to my next distinction between hungry people versus angry people. When people have their disposable income squeezed because of higher food prices, they do become angry, including angry at their own government. Even though they may not be hungry, they are angry and they can become politically dangerous. But the other side of the coin is that genuinely hungry people are seldom politically dangerous to governments. There are plenty of genuinely malnourished people out there, more than 800 million according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. But these people seldom present a serious threat to their government, which is one reason those governments so often ignore their plight. They don't present a threat because most of them live in rural areas. They're physically cut off from the political arena. In Africa, most rural dwellers, 70% of rural dwellers in Africa live more than 2 kilometers from the nearest paved road. They're physically isolated from politics. Most chronically malnourished people are politically inactive either because they are illiterate and unaware and not a member of any organized political group, or, and this is the larger group, they're politically inactive because they are infants under the age of 2, or they are nursing or pregnant women with plenty of other things to worry about other than politics. And when people do take to the streets, here's another distinction. My goal here is to encourage analytic clarity. That's what universities are good at. It's impossible for journalists to maintain all of these tedious distinctions when they try to cover these issues in a one-page story in the newspaper, but our job at universities is to try to maintain some of these distinctions. When people do take to the streets in the developing world, we have to be careful not to assume it's a riot. A riot is when street mobs become violent, destroy things, and start stealing things. A lot of street demonstrations in the developing world are not riots. People will march, yell, wave signs, burn things in effigy, but that's a demonstration. That's not a riot. And this is closer to political business as usual in many developing countries than it is to something disturbing or unsettling that's worthy of international attention. In the developing world, opposition political parties, student groups, unions, religious groups, for these people, street demonstrations are an affordable, maybe the only affordable and available means of political expression. It's a little bit like paying a lobbyist to talk to a legislator in the United States, or taking out a political ad, or blogging. They don't have access to those things, so they may not even have access to votes. So for them, street demonstrations is political expression, but it's not necessarily a riot. And one more distinction, when social unrest occurs, whether it's a demonstration or a riot, it is not always a precursor to political change. In 2007, 2008, when there were so many so-called food riots in more than a dozen countries, political change, serious political change, occurred in only one country, Haiti. And the government of Haiti has been dysfunctional now for several decades. There have been plenty of political changes. It doesn't really require high food prices to produce political change in a country like Haiti. I can think of a lot of governments I would like to see toppled out there. And I sometimes wish a food riot would be all it would take, for example, to knock over the Assad regime in Syria. As we can see, it takes much more than that sometimes to secure serious political change. One more distinction between food conflicts and so-called food wars. When violent conflict does break out, let's say over food, or more likely over control of agricultural land, I'm glad the point was raised earlier, or water, we have to distinguish between internal conflicts, which are not terribly unusual. For example, the fighting in the Rift Valley in Kenya several years ago. What was at issue here was an effort to push out Kikuyu, who had taken over this land in 1964 after the British left Kenya. This was an inter-ethnic conflict over the control of agricultural land. Such internal conflicts are not unusual, but international warfare over food or agricultural land or water is highly unusual. We often hear predictions about future water wars, and it may yet happen. But until now, there is simply not one modern example of two nation states going to war over fresh water or over agricultural land, let alone food. There are conflicts, political disagreements, that is. There may be threats, but there is not a single example of such a war. In fact, if you look at what nations agree on when they sign treaties, the single largest category of international treaties is treaties over water. Water is something that nation states usually agree about formally rather than go to war over. Finally, the land grab issue. There has been, since 2007-2008, a significant increase in international land acquisitions. Governments like Saudi Arabia or Qatar or the Emirates or China or India or South Korea have rented, they've either leased or they've purchased agricultural land in places like Ethiopia or Sudan or Tanzania. There are now more than a dozen private investment funds with $2 billion or more looking to acquire still more agricultural land in Africa. But I would argue that the international dimension of this phenomenon is not a grab. It's a willing buyer, willing seller relationship, with the willing seller usually being, or the willing leaser usually being, the African government in question. It's the domestic dimension of this phenomenon that is a grab, because the African governments involved usually sell or lease the land without the consent and without providing compensation to the agricultural or the pastoralist users of that land. It's a domestic land grab by a government from its own people, not an international land grab. So having made these distinctions, I'd like to reconsider the alarmist scenario I started with, where high international food prices are supposed to be causing sociopolitical unrest. The original inspiration for this scenario was 2008, and I would argue that even here, in retrospect, there was far more going on. We think of 2008, because this is a food conference, we think of 2008 as a year of unusually high food prices. Well, food prices were high, But commodity prices were high across the board. In fact, average commodity prices spiked much more than food prices in 2008 on the world market. And fuel prices spiked even more than average commodity prices. This chart shows non-food commodity prices rising far more dramatically than food prices. Food commodities are the red line at the bottom. Non-food commodities, all food commodities are the black line in the middle, and crude oil is the blue line at the top. Notice in the world of commodity price spikes, food in 2008 was a bit player. So if inflation, if commodity price inflation drives people into the streets in anger, as it did in 2008, we should describe it not as a food riot, but a commodity price inflation riot, and allocate only a part of the responsibility to high food prices. As for 2011 and the assumed link between high international wheat prices and the Arab Spring uprisings in Tunisia and Libya and Egypt, uprisings that did topple governments, by the way, I do not buy into the view that these events, which began in Tunisia, and Tunisia became the demonstration effect that led to Libya and Egypt. I do not buy into the argument that these events were a response to high food prices. The Tunisian events were certainly not a response to hunger. In Tunisia in 2010, the year the demonstrations began, almost nobody was seriously undernourished. Only 3% of children in Tunisia in 2010 were underweight, which the global average is 15%. So Tunisia is an extremely well-fed country by global standards. The demonstrations began after a young street vendor burned himself to death to protest the behavior of a government official, a policewoman, who had publicly humiliated him by slapping him after he refused to pay a bribe. The event triggered then national outrage, not over high food prices, but over a corrupt government that the people simply couldn't take anymore. When they took to the streets, if you asked them what they wanted, they said, "We want dignity. We want democracy. We want jobs." They didn't say we want cheap bread. In fact, the government tried to satisfy them by increasing bread subsidies to drive down the price of bread. It had no effect at all on the trajectory of the protests. So here's my alternative explanation for food riots. First, in the 2007-2008 price spike, I'd say it wasn't hunger. It was an income squeeze, and the income squeeze was a result of commodity price inflation and inflation across the board, not just higher food prices. In 2010-2011, the Arab Spring was a result not of high food prices but of the illegitimacy of Arab regimes, the demonstration effects of the political change in Tunisia, and the spread of social media in Egypt in particular. And as for 2012, we've got high food prices once again. But no food riots. So I would say take a deep breath and maintain some clear distinctions in your mind, and don't jump too quickly to the conclusion that the FAO Index of World Prices is a barometer of political instability. Thanks, and I'll stop there. Mm-hmm.